It's time for the Daily Service, led by Andrew Grayston. Here on FM, our new Book of the Week. Hull West MP, the Right Honourable Alan Johnson, has written a second volume of memoirs chronicling the career that took him to high office as a senior government minister. We begin with a teenage Alan contemplating his future.
It's Christmas Eve 1967, a Saturday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm waiting for Mike. Mrs. Kenny's large flat in Hamlet Gardens, Hammersmith, is empty except for me, cocooned in the room I rent at the elbow of the L-shaped passage. I'm 17 years old, a shelf stacker at Anthony Jackson's supermarket on the Upper Richmond Road in East Sheen. A temporary measure, I tell myself, to fill the interval between school and rock stardom. Ahead lies 1968, plump with promise. I'm convinced that for the band I'm with, the In-Betweens, this will be the year we hit the big time. What actually lay ahead in 1968 was the end of my nascent music career, marriage, fatherhood, a new job as a postman, and a return to my home turf, London, West End. Anthony Jackson's had closed that lunchtime. Johnny Ferrugia, its larger-than-life Maltese manager, had taken his devoted staff, Kath, Sandra and me, to the pub opposite for a Christmas drink. We'd worked hard and our boss wanted to show his appreciation. I explained that I had to be home by 3:30 because Mike, my brother-in-law, was picking me up in his Rover 110 to drive me to Watford, where I was to spend Christmas with him, my sister Linda and my four-month-old niece. Johnny Ferrugia fussed over us in the pub, insisting on buying all the drinks. After clinking our glasses in a Christmas toast, he distributed our presents. I knew what my present was as soon as I saw the shape of the package. Johnny was well aware that I idolised the Beatles. He'd heard me wax lyrical about Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the album that had astounded and delighted the world on its release in June, becoming the soundtrack to the Summer of Love. And we stood together in the warehouse at the back of the store, like mourners at a funeral, as A Day in the Life wafted its beauty from the big blue portable radio as the last track ever played on Radio Caroline. Now, a few hours after that Christmas drink, I sat in the fusty damask comfort of my room, waiting for Mike, who was already more than 2 hours late. What I wanted to do was strum my much-loved Spanish guitar. I still remember the song I wrote in the gathering dusk. But it was long finished by the time Mike eventually rang my doorbell, just after 7. "Sorry I'm late," he said as we walked down the stairs to his car. "I went for a drink after work." As we approached the Rover, I could see that there was somebody sitting in the front passenger seat. "Oh, this is Harry," said Mike by way of introduction to an elderly Irish gentleman who exuded a tipsy bonhomie. "He's coming home with us for Christmas." As I sat on the stitched leather of the plush rear seat, it began to dawn on me, to my increasing horror, that Mike was very, very drunk. I remonstrated as best I could as I was thrown from side to side in the back of this unguided missile, which could have been fueled by the fumes emanating from the front seats. When the car finally pulled up in Watford, the relief was overwhelming. I felt like James Stewart in the final scene of It's a Wonderful Life, exhilarated by the knowledge that I was now more certain to live beyond the age of 17 and to experience all that life still had in store for me. The future I had mapped out in my mind had taken a different course when I met Judith Elizabeth Cox. Within a few months, I had asked her to be my wife. Judy was a single mother. Her daughter Natalie, born in 1966, would complete the picture of domestic bliss that we'd begun to paint in our imaginations. Judy and Natalie lived with Judy's grandmother in Camelford Road back in Notting Hill, just off Ladbroke Grove, amid the streets where Linda and I had spent our childhood. Our plan was to put our names down for a council house as soon as we were married. My sister Linda was horrified. She saw it as her job to support me. To date, I hadn't exactly been cooperative. I'd left school at 15 when Linda urged me to stay on. I'd refused to move to Watford with her and Mike. Now I was adding to her sense of having failed by marrying a woman with a child and moving back to the mean streets we'd grown up in. As Judy and I planned our future, my musical career suffered a crushing blow. On the verge of what the in-betweens were confident would be our breakthrough, all of our musical equipment, including my precious Hofner Very Thin guitar, was stolen from the room above the Pied Bull pub in Islington, where we stored it between gigs. I couldn't afford to buy a new guitar. I'd only just finished paying off the 30-month hire purchase installments on an amplifier that had been stolen, uninsured, needless to say, when my first band, The Area, had been the victims of another robbery. It was clear that domestic bliss would be unsustainable on my wages at Anthony Jackson's. I was going to have to get a better paid and more secure job. It was Sham, the bass guitarist in the in-betweens, who pointed me in the direction of the post office. The pay wasn't great, he told me, but as a result, the post office found it hard to attract staff, which meant there were always loads of vacancies and plenty of opportunities for overtime. And so, in June 1968, I became a postman in Barnes, London Southwest 13. The entire mail system for what was then still the General Post Office, this was its final year as a government department, was operated by hand. The only machine was a stamp canceller which postmarked all the outward letters. The part of it that recorded the date was subject to tight security. All kinds of scams could be facilitated through unauthorised access to a GPO date stamp, such as counterfeit proof of postage for Paul's claims, and so on. There were two starting times for the delivery staff, 5:30 a.m. and 6 a.m. On arrival, they would finish off the inward sorting before collecting the mail for their own walk, taking it to the delivery bench for prepping and then tying it into hand-sized bundles numbered in the sequence in which they were to be delivered. So important was it that the majority of customers received their first post before leaving the house for work, that the inward sorting would be cut off before it had all been processed to ensure that postmen could complete their walks by 9:30 a.m. Such were the mechanics of the job, the familiar rhythm of a great public institution, serving the needs of the 10,000 or so residents of the charming riverside district of Barnes. It was a process that would have barely changed in the 100-odd years since Rowland Hill's reforms and the Penny Black had made postal services available to the masses. We postmen were uniformed civil servants, proud to be performing a public service essential to the country's social fabric. While my sister Linda had found out she was expecting her first child 3 months after her wedding, I learned I was to be a father 3 months before mine. I was still only 17. Judy and I absorbed the news with mixed emotions. While we were both delighted, there were anxieties too. I was thrilled at the prospect of fathering a child, but I acknowledged that parenthood wasn't likely to come naturally to me. But I'd persevere, and I had the example of my own father to guide me in what not to do, a kind of reverse role model. For Judy, there were other considerations. She had already endured the stigma of being an unmarried mother, attitudes having changed little in working-class communities through the so-called swinging 60s, and was concerned about suffering further damage to her reputation. She didn't want our marriage to be labelled a shotgun wedding. Our little soap opera was being played out against the backdrop of social and political revolution. For Judy and me, and millions like us, these events might just as well have been taking place in a parallel universe, for all the difference they made to us. I was about to become a married man with two children. I didn't want to abolish money. I needed to earn the bloody stuff. I'd been approached to join the union on my first day in the sorting office by Reg, the cook, who was also the branch treasurer. As well as explaining the importance of joining, he suggested I take out a policy with the union's insurance society that would mature when I reached the retirement age of 60 and supplement my civil service pension. Although I found it impossible to focus on retirement while still in my teens, I duly signed up for everything Reg put in front of me. While the contributions made a dent in my wages of £10 per week, it seemed a prudent thing to do. Within a week or so, I'd received my Union of Post Office Workers membership card. My knowledge of current affairs, if embryonic, was sufficient for me to understand the role of trade unions and convince me of their necessity. Strange as it may sound, although I bought the Times regularly, I never read it in front of anyone at work. I would take it home to peruse later. To have sat reading it in the canteen would have looked pretentious, as if I was showing off. In truth, there was much in the Times I found incomprehensible, such as many of the leader columns and articles opposite them, which seemed to be written in a code I didn't know, but which I was intent on deciphering. We were about to become part of a news story ourselves. The union was preparing to go on strike. The UPW had decided that all grades in the largest cities and towns in Britain would be called out on a strike in support of 3,000 highly skilled operatives known as overseas telegraph officers who handled telegrams. The strike duly took place on the 30th of January 1969, the first national strike in the union's history. As far as I'm aware, there was no picket line outside Barnes' sorting office. If there was, I wasn't on it. For me, the strike meant a welcome 5-day week instead of the 6 days I was used to working. Losing a day's pay was a blow to the family finances, of course, but I used this unexpected day at leisure to good effect by preparing one of my poems for publication. I hadn't had a great deal of time to write very much more since leaving school, apart from the songs I always felt would offer a faster route to fame and fortune. Then my eye had been caught by an advertisement inviting submissions for a volume of poetry to be published in May. It was a vanity publication. Writers would have to pay for the privilege of seeing their work in print rather than being paid for it. I think the cost was around £5 per poem, more than half a week's wages for me. I had saved enough to submit a single offering, a poem entitled Youth. On a Saturday lunchtime in May, I was sitting in the pub opposite Barnes Green. I'd finished my delivery and was enjoying a pint before cycling home. I was keeping an ear out in case the payphone fixed to the wall should ring. When it did, I leapt up to answer it. Sure enough, it was Judy calling from the phone box on the corner of St. Mark's Road. In her hand was a parcel from the Regency Press, Spring Poets 69. She wouldn't open it, she promised, until I arrived home. It contained 504 poems. On page 205, I found my solitary contribution. Youth. In frantic years we grow to be people of the world, in frantic years that are supposed to teach us, and we never really know why we're supposed to know, as a thousand clammy hands stretch out to reach us. And as we sail the balmy years on our cushioned little cloud, we have no mind or thought of what's ahead. Each pimply worry dies in the freedom of our cries, and crumples on the shelter of our bed. It takes a lot to learn, an awful lot to learn, that all the time you ran, your future followed. The beard is on your face. You've slammed the book and lost your place, and the bitter pill of life is slowly swallowed. I concede that it's not exactly T.S. Eliot. However, in my defence, I reckon it's positively Shakespearean compared with some of the other poems contained in this, to quote the blurb on the cover, fine anthology. By the age of 18, I was both a recording artist and a published poet. The small detail that it was a demo disc and a vanity publication was to me immaterial. I was convinced that these achievements were just the foundations of an artistic career to which I would return when circumstances allowed.
Please, Mr. Postman was written and read by Alan Johnson. It's a Heavy Entertainment production for BBC Radio 4. Coming up after the news, choosing a secondary school and the art of flirting in Woman's Hour.
Got to make a decision now, Sarah, and you're the expert. Do I put my waterproof trousers on?
No.
OK.
Claire Balding embarks on her first leg of the Dales Way. She's joined by the outdoor clothing entrepreneur, Sarah Howcroft.
We all really appreciate how walking is good for our health, but for our mental and certainly our spiritual well-being, I think it's fundamental.
The new series of Ramblings starts on Thursday at 3 on BBC Radio 4.